A new novel tells the story of a medieval mission to bring Roger Bacon's great treatise on the world to the Pope.
John, who is based on a real person of whom probably not much more is known than his name was John. He was Roger Bacon's favourite pupil, and he was trusted to take Roger Bacon's great book to deliver it to the Pope. The Chronicle is a sort of record of temptations and trials. And the temptations are not necessarily into sin, although they might be. They're temptations to lead, to pull him away from his mission, his duty.
That's David Flussbetter. He tells us about his wonderful novel, John the Pupil. It's a kind of medieval road trip and coming-of-age story. And then another work of fiction that reimagines history.
Maya Deserci actually made it to the city, and he lived here in New York until 1987. He died when he was actually 95. And while he was living here, anonymously, he eventually started going to the public library on 42nd Street and 5th Avenue, and he began to compose this sequel to the Arcades Project, which he called the Manhattan Project. Now, my book is not his book. My book is essentially just an analysis of that text that was never written.
That's urban philosopher David Kishik. His book, The Manhattan Project, imagines what Walter Benjamin would have written about New York had he succeeded in escaping to the U.S. from Nazi-dominated Europe. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Historical novels face some challenges that fiction based in contemporary reality doesn't. They have to get their historical facts right and paint a convincing picture of the society in which they're set. And that's what most good historical novels do. But often their characters speak in an anachronistically modern voice, which fails to capture how people in earlier centuries actually thought. In his new novel, John the Pupil, David Flussbetter succeeds where so much other historical fiction fails. In the book's eponymous main character, he creates a compelling voice that seems to come to us directly from the 13th century. John is a young friar who's been charged by his teacher, the great natural philosopher Roger Bacon, with bringing the latter's magnum opus to Pope Clement IV at a time when both Bacon and the Pope were battling powerful enemies. Young John the Pupil's journey is a perilous one. Along the way, he encounters not only the predators of the medieval road, but also temptations and moral dilemmas. As his mettle is tested, he traverses not only national boundaries, but also the boundaries of the medieval society he's grown up in, to imagine greater choices for himself as an individual. In addition to John the Pupil, David Flussbetter is the author of 6 previous novels, including The Gift. Well, David Flussbetter, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
I love this book, John the Pupil. I found it a complete delight to read and very informative also about a history that I didn't know a whole lot about. Your protagonist is a 13th century monk, John the Pupil of the title, who is a pupil of Roger Bacon. Since the novel is in the first person, John himself does not tell us a whole lot about the background of Roger Bacon, and I wonder if you could, because he's so central to this book.
Yes, I'd be happy to. And sorry to correct you, but every now and again I get a slightly peeved letter from a Franciscan or a Dominican who blames me for people calling John and Roger Bacon a monk when he's strictly a friar.
I see. What is the difference?
Monks stay in one place, friars go on the road. So, you know, monks withdraw from the community, friars go into the community.
And is Roger Bacon a friar?
He's a Franciscan, so he's a friar, even though he's quite monkish in his habits.
So to speak.
I knew probably less than you did when I started to write this book. It took a lot of research. But Roger Bacon was sort of one of the great men of the age. It was a time when maybe the last time when an individual could presume to know everything. And he sort of set about trying to know everything, ranging from optics and lenses to rediscovering gunpowder to trying to calculate time. So proved that the calendar was incorrect. All these things. And John, who is based on a real person of whom probably not much more is known than his name was John. He was Roger Bacon's favourite pupil, and he was trusted to take Roger Bacon's great book to deliver it to the Pope.
Now, this book is written in the first person. To a 21st century person, the language is spot on. It's exactly how I would have imagined that somebody of the 13th century might have spoken. Could you talk about how you constructed his voice?
Part of what I had to do, I think, was to forget stuff. So, for example, I think native English speakers, any Anglophone speaker is influenced by the King James Bible and the rhythms of the King James Bible, certainly in the UK, and I think in the States as well, have certainly influenced the way people have written and the way people have thought. And so I had to try to push that all aside. So I went back to the Bible that John would have used was the Vulgate Bible, which would have been written in Latin and have a completely different sort of rhythmic structure to that sort of 17th century High English. And then I just read lots. I set myself the rule that I wasn't allowed to read anything later than 1300. So I allowed myself to read some Dante, who was useful for sort of, philosophical background. So I read Chronicles, of which there were a few. I read sermons, just trying to get into, the rhythms of speech, or possibly thought, how people would describe things, to themselves and to each other.
And it's a very compelling voice. And there's a kind of cogent simplicity to it. Is that something that emerged out of your reading, or does it come out of the character of John himself?
I think out of the character. So, at the beginning, there isn't much description of the physical world, or as you say, of the background to Roger Bacon, his master. Because he would have been very fixed on the temporal world, on the world of redemption and Christian categories. So, for them, certainly someone with a religious education, clerical education, the physical, immediate physical world is something to look beyond. And that, of course, will influence what he would choose to write about. But I think as it goes on, the world begins to mean more to him, to have more impact upon him.
And, of course, this is the first trip that he's taken outside the walls of the friary since he was a child. We're talking about John here. So he has set this great task to go on this journey to bring this great book to the Pope. There is a copy of the book in existence, is that right?
Yeah, there are two or three copies, yes. Original copies.
Talk a little bit about the politics around this book and its reception and why Bacon needed somebody like John to take it directly to the Pope on such a perilous journey.
There's a lot of dispute about this still. So when I was researching, there seemed a lot, which is great for a novelist, that there's a lot of uncertainty. So, for example, most current historians have Roger Bacon living in France, probably Paris, at this time. I've put him in England, just outside Oxford. I think because, this perilous journey of John's, I think any big journey needs to start with the protagonist crossing a body of water. Somehow France is too close to Italy. It wouldn't be such a sort of, grand adventure. But then I consulted historians and they had to admit that they don't actually know where Roger Bacon was. And similarly, a lot of the politics is subject to, you know, interpretation and guesswork. I mean, what's clear is that Roger Bacon had become a Franciscan friar sort of halfway through his career. And it's a little bit unclear why he became a friar. And then what's also unclear is how antagonistic the order was to him and he to the order. So in my book, he's basically under house arrest. So he's allowed to continue with his researches and studies. And Bacon is someone who, even though, you know, everything is always a branch of theology, you know, this is a world in which God exists everywhere, and probably the final judgment, end of all times, is imminent. You know, so everything is theological, but he still believed in trusting his senses and looking at the evidence that his senses would bring. And he was writing about this. So he was allowed to write and probably not allowed to disseminate his knowledge beyond the order. Except he had some influential friends, and one of his influential friends was Clement IV, the Pope, who Bacon, I think, to get a little bit more sort of, you know, autonomy for himself, had more or less bragged to the Pope that he had written the great book, the Opus Majus, that would contain pretty much the sum of all wisdom, and a lot of it a practical application. So, for example, yeah, machinery of war, possible medicines, certainly a lot of medicines, possibly the secret of immortality and the Philosopher's Stone. You know, the Pope, either deliberately on Bacon's account or inadvertently, but probably deliberately, believed Bacon had written this book, then asked for it. Bacon had to quickly write this book. So my novel begins with the book nearing its hurried completion. And then Bacon, probably under this sort of house arrest, entrusts his pupil to deliver it because he's not allowed to leave the friary.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with novelist David Flussvetter about his latest book, John the Pupil. It's out from HarperCollins. In fact, there's some inventions in the book, like gunpowder. I did a little bit of reading. Actually, it was the footnotes. You have some wonderful footnotes that you put in the back that I didn't even realize were there because I was so absorbed in the reading of the book until I reached the end of the book.
Yes, don't tell anyone. The aim is that you read the book how I would hope my ideal reader would read the book, that they get to the end of the story. And then there's this sort of pseudo-scholarly apparatus at the end of it.
Pseudo?
Well, it's written by an unnamed editor-translator who is, yes, he's quite scholarly and learned, but he's got a rather fussy manner, and I don't necessarily agree with everything he says.
But the information in there is stuff that you gleaned, obviously, from your research.
Yes.
So there were some discoveries here that were suppressed because the book itself was suppressed. It was burned. Am I giving too much away?
The book wasn't burned. The book was Bacon's library, both of the books that he had collected and his own writings were covered in, I think they were covered in white cloth and turned to face the wall for a couple of hundred years after his death. There was, as you said, there are a few original Opus Majuses, or Opus Magi, and there's the Opus Minus, which is the book he wrote immediately after, and then there was a third book as well. So he did rediscover gunpowder. I mean, he didn't invent it. The Chinese had invented it originally. And also what he had done is read closely in the great Arabic scholars. So this is sort of, you know, 100, 200 years before, most of the learning in the world was being done in North Africa and southern Spain. And those books were now being translated into Latin. And Bacon had read them, I think, more closely than most people in Europe had read. So he was incorporating new sort of mathematical thinking as well.
So, back to John, he goes on this perilous journey. And as you've already alluded to, John, during the course of the journey, he changes a little bit in his perspective. He's beginning to see the wider world. He's also becoming more individualized in some way. It almost seems he's traversing the journey from the medieval collective to the modern individual.
Yeah, I haven't seen it quite in that way, but yes, that's right. He's left the friary. He's having experiences which are moving him in ways that are entirely unexpected to him. You know, so he is becoming, so, you know, part of what the reader is following is someone growing up, is someone becoming the person they're going to become. I'm interested by what you say, that he's becoming modern, so he's becoming an individual, which, I wouldn't argue against that.
I said that because he confronts the whole issue of choice. I mean, it seems to me in the Middle Ages, you were born into a certain station, you did your duty, you never deviated from it. But Roger Bacon himself deviated, and John is deviating as well, and he's thinking about other possibilities for his life.
Yeah, that's definitely right. I hadn't seen it in terms of sort of, you know, medieval versus modern. But, you know, that's right. At the beginning, and the Chronicle is a sort of record of, self-consciously, I think, on his part, a record of temptations and trials. And the temptations are not necessarily into sin, although they might be. They're temptations to lead, to pull him away from his mission, his duty, which is, you know, to deliver the book, his master's book. And his duty, certainly in the beginning of the first half or so of the book, is unquestionable, is unquestioned. You know, nothing, you know, he would die rather than not fulfill his master's wishes. So yes, it is about someone, daring to decide and choose and think for themselves, up to a point. I mean, I think he would still be a 13th century figure rather than a 21st century figure.
Right. Now, during the course of his journey, and I should say he's accompanied by other companions, but I'll concentrate on John because this is his story, he comes into a village and meets a local saint, a young woman who bears the stigmata on her palms and feet. And as a consequence, a local church is much neglected. Is this also part of some transitioning from the traditional establishment authority of the Middle Ages to a more personalized religion, or is it something else?
Yes. I mean, I hope that whole episode is sort of open to some interpretation, and possibly, you know, there might be a sort of commercial reason behind it all, because there've been the lands have become despoiled and the economy of that area had been suffering, and this emergence of a local saint has transformed the economy. You know, it's not just taken people away from the church; it's brought pilgrims to the village.
Right, it's tourism.
It's tourism, yeah. And pilgrims require, you know, food to eat. They need to drink. They're probably, if they've got any money, they're going to want to buy relics. So there's a whole economy has now built. The town, the village, which had been, you know, blighted, is now flourishing. That's open to interpretation. You know, I don't think John would have seen it like that. I think John would be more believing in the sanctity of what's going on. But it was also, you know, there were these lay saints, particularly in Italy around that time, And most of them were women, or a lot of them were women. You know, it was one of the few, I was trying to think of a word, occupation is not quite the right word, and profession certainly isn't the right word, endeavor, that a woman could actually thrive in for a while, away from all the sort of pre-existing social religious structures, which I think is also quite interesting.
And we are talking with David Flussvetter about his newest novel, John the Pupil. It's about a perilous journey undertaken by a young Franciscan friar who is carrying Roger Bacon's Magnus Opus to the Pope in 13th century Europe. I did wonder at the history of all of this. It seemed like there was so much influx going on at this time. Is that because of the Black Death or...?
It's pre-Black Death. Mm-hmm. So this was... Yeah, this is like a generation before... Well, yeah, generation or two before the Black Death. Mm-hmm. But Italy was in a state of civil war. So John's destination is Viterbo, which is, I think, 30 or 40 miles outside of Rome, because the Holy Roman Emperor, who was German, had taken control of Rome. So Italy was in a state of civil war that was nearing its end, and the forces of the Pope were going to win out shortly and beat back the Germans. And although there are Italians on both sides. So Europe was, Italy particularly, was a war zone. But I think also the point that people were, from how I understand the period, people were expecting the world to end shortly. You know, Christianity is a religion of end times. You know, the just will be saved, the sinners will be damned, and Jesus will rise again, and God will bless all the elect in the new dispensation. And I think in this time, that was certainly in the forefront. You know, people were expecting. And this is also one of the things that interested me at the beginning, that when you look at sort of medieval art and you see angels and demons in the pictures, and I was trying to imagine what a 13th century person saw when they looked outside. You know, are they seeing these angels and demons, or are they purely metaphorical or allegorical? And the conclusion I eventually came to was that, and this isn't an original point, is that reality would have existed on any number of levels. You know, so there's the material level, then there's the allegorical level, then there's the moral level. You know, so all these things were existing at the same time. All these processes were existing at the same time, and at the top of it were the actions of good and evil, as represented in these pictures of angels and demons.
What drew you to this story?
Lack of knowledge. I mean, originally I'd become very disgruntled. I was writing a book that I'd stopped believing in, and I'd been writing it for 2 or 3 years at least. And I'd broken away from it to write something else, which I'd finished and published, and then I got back to this. And there's this strange sort of feeling that you feel committed to the project the longer it goes on. But then the longer it goes on, the more I felt I didn't like it very much. And then if I didn't like it very much, why should I expect other people to read it? And I was in the British Library, where I sometimes flee to when I don't know what else to do, in London. And there was a character in my book, in this abandoned book, that was interested in explosives. So I was reading up about the history of explosives to try to pretend to myself I was working, dignifying it, calling it research, but it was just, doing something that, and that led me to Roger Bacon and his rediscovery of gunpowder. And I was reading a biography of Bacon written in the 1950s, which had a footnote, which was something like, in 1267, Roger Bacon entrusted his pupil John with a copy of the Opus Majus to deliver to the Pope. Something like that. And I just had, it was one of those light bulb lighting up in a balloon above my head moments, and thought that, you know, that isn't a footnote, that's a novel. And I was going to write it. So I just abandoned this book, thankfully, that I've been labouring over, and set myself the task of writing that novel. There's just something so exciting about it. And, you know, I like the idea of a 17-year-old boy delivering a, you know, crossing Europe to deliver a book to the Pope. I mean, you know, it's a great line. But then I had to, the two huge challenges were, one, I had to learn enough to be able to write it, to feel that I understood enough, at least to my own satisfaction. And then the second one, which we've talked about a little bit, of finding the way to write it, finding John's voice and John's manner. And then once I got that, pretty much the rest fell into place, except I broke off about halfway through and decided I needed to do the journey myself. So, I mean, not entirely on foot. I walked from Canterbury to Dover and then got a boat, and then a variety of means of transport. I would walk, catch a train, walk, hire a car for a bit, you know. And there was something which felt slightly superstitious, but that I wanted to cover some of that actual terrain myself, even if it was entirely different ground now.
And did that help?
It did, yes. It really did. And when I got back, yes, it was then written fairly quickly after that.
How long did that journey take?
Well, it should. If I'd done it properly, it would have taken months and months. I only had enough, I didn't have enough time. So it took about 2.5 weeks. And one of the extraordinary things about that is just being on your own for that length of time is productive and creative. You know, I speak pretty much no Italian and very odd, erratic French. You know, so my interactions with people were limited, and I would stay in a very basic accommodation, you know, travel. So it was spending a lot of time thinking and walking, which were, yeah, very productive.
Well, it's a wonderful novel. I have to say it's my new favorite. It's called John the Pupil, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us. It's been just a fascinating conversation.
I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Next up, David Kishik's study of an imaginary work by Walter Benjamin. Stay tuned after the break.
Ave Regina Celorum, Ave Domina Angelorum, Salve Radix, Salve Porta, Ex qua mundo lux est morta. Gaude Virgo gloriosa, super omnes speciosa. Vale o valde decora.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When the German philosopher Walter Benjamin, or Benjamin as it's often pronounced, committed suicide on the French-Spanish border in 1940, he left behind one of the most brilliant and idiosyncratic cultural critiques of a city the world has ever known. Unfinished at the time of his death, the Arcades Project was a massive collection of notes about Paris, filled with penetrating insights, fragmentary analyses, and vivid descriptions of the city in which Benjamin spent the last 13 years of his life. Walter Benjamin killed himself in despair on finding the Spanish border temporarily closed when he was trying to flee Nazi-occupied France and make it to New York City, where he'd obtained a visa to teach at the new school. But what if he faked his suicide? What if he actually made it to New York? And what if he continued his investigations of urban philosophy by pursuing a Manhattan project, like the Arcades Project about Paris? That's the thesis of David Kishik's new book, The Manhattan Project, A Theory of a City. The book is a scholarly study of an imaginary text by Benjamin about New York. An urban philosopher himself, Kishik examines the city through the lens of Benjamin's sensibility. For lovers of New York, Walter Benjamin, Jane Jacobs, and urban philosophy in general, it's a fascinating exploration of Manhattan as the capital city of the 20th century. David Kishik teaches in the Institute for Liberal Arts and Interdisciplinary Studies at Emerson College. He's also the author of Wittgenstein's Form of Life and The Power of Life. Well, David Kishik, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca, for having me.
This wonderful book, The Manhattan Project, is a work really of urban philosophy and cultural criticism wrapped in the cloak of a speculative fiction, a kind of disquisition on a work by Walter Benjamin that doesn't exist. Explain.
My idea was, after 2 years of doing research for this book that was basically influenced by the Arcades Project, to write some kind of a book about 20th century Manhattan as the capital of the 20th century, I just couldn't write it for about 2 years. And after I came to think about this basically sort of a postmodern ploy, it became much more easier for me to actually write the book. And the idea was to extend Benjamin's life, who died in 1940 as he was escaping the Nazis on the border between France and Spain on his way to New York. My idea is that he actually made it to the city, and he lived here in New York until 1987. He died when he was actually 95. And while he was living here anonymously, he eventually started going to the public library on 42nd Street and Fifth Avenue, and he began to compose this sequel to the Arcades Project, which he called the Manhattan Project. Now, my book is not his book. My book is essentially just an analysis of that text that was never written.
Yes, and that's a kind of a fascinating meta view, because you're not writing it as Benjamin, and yet you do seem to channel Benjamin. And I pronounce it Benjamin because that's probably how most of our listeners will hear it, but Walter Benjamin. I've read part of the Arcades Project, Paris, the capital of the 19th century. Tell us a little bit about that real book that Benjamin wrote. So tell us a little bit about Walter Benjamin himself and who he was, because while the Arcades Project is well known among a certain circle of people or people of a certain affinity, it's not particularly a mass cultural phenomenon.
It cannot be, because it's not actually a book. It's basically his notes that he made in preparation to that book, that maybe he could have finished it if he actually lived that long, but some people say that it was an impossible project. I think that maybe the way by which I channel him has to do with the way this book is written. So maybe I can say something about that. The book as we have it is based on this distinction into what is called convolutes, basically sheafs of papers that he basically organized according to certain themes, subjects, places, architectonic symbols, all those different themes that composed basically what would have become essentially his book at the end, which is the way basically I also walk. I will read all this secondary literature on New York, and I will organize in this according to very similar essentially themes. And a big part of what I was trying to do in this book was to translate certain elements from his book on Paris to my book on New York.
And you say there are what you call elective affinities that are revealed between the two cities, almost as if, I mean, they are not the same, but one gives rise to the other, and they're in a kind of dialectical relationship.
Precisely. Dialectics is something that is true also within every city in and of itself. Because Benjamin thought about the Arcades Project as essentially a philosophy of modernity, through his analysis of 19th century Paris, he was trying to make sense of what does it mean to live in the modern world. In the same way, I'm trying to basically append or just create some kind of an adjustment to his work by trying to speak of 20th century New York in order to create a different type of what modernity is. So many of his elements will be moved into a different direction. For instance, theoretical hero of Benjamin's book was Karl Marx. And therefore, the book is essentially some kind of a, I wouldn't call it communist. Benjamin was a pretty bad Marxist, people will say. It wasn't in any way a dogmatic one. I am also very much influenced by Marx's work, by an attempt to think about the city in its materiality, but I also move in different directions. And one of the ways by which I move beyond Benjamin is to start talking about Hannah Arendt rather than Marx as my personal hero. Arendt, who lived in New York until her death at the late 70s, basically will create a rather critical attitude towards Marx. And I will follow that critique in order to actually move from a thought about the city as an economic entity, although I will talk about that as well pretty extensively, into a thought about the city as a truly, maybe the true political entity.
You, in fact, say that the modern city, the city of the 20th century, New York as its apotheosis, I guess, is a place where you call it the ecopolis, or the ecopolis. I'm not sure how you would pronounce that, but a place where the economy and politics are interpenetrated. Could you explain what you mean by that, and how is that different, say, than Berlin or London or, cities of past centuries?
Ecopolis is very much based on Arendt's work. The thought for Arendt was that Athens is divided. The Athenians divided their lives, basically. They lived a rather split life between the home and the city, between the oikos and the polis. In the oikos, they will live this life that they actually called zoe. They had a special word for life in the household. And that life will be based on essentially economic necessities. And what she means, what the Greeks meant by economy, was anything that had to do with the household, including sleeping, eating, work, and the money that you can get out of it was just a part of that. The way they will treat their kids, the way they will treat their slaves was all a part of the oikos, as well as having sex. All of the biological necessities of life. The polis was a completely different place for them. When they left the darkness of the oikos and moved into the light of the public sphere, into the polis, into politics, their life transformed from the fact of life to the form of life, to the meaning of life. And that is what the city was about. It was a space where you will speak and act in public. Arendt believes that that separation is lost in modernity. And I follow her work in that sense, that I no longer think that we separate the home from the city. This is something that perhaps already began to unravel in 19th century Paris. Benjamin will talk about the flâneur, the one that, who will walk around the streets of Paris, treating the street as if it was his personal living room. So you can see how the outside begins to be an inside and an inside begins to be an outside. But I do think that that movement really got into its full manifestation in 20th century New York, where we can no longer distinguish between what is public and what is private. And therefore, I think that the only way we could really make sense of our lives today is to imagine that new space that I call an ecopolis.
Could you give us an example of what you're talking about?
There are all these funny quotes that I would find in like old New Yorker magazines where people will say that home is the place you go as a last resort, or where you go to change, basically. In opposition to Paris, where people would treat the outside, and even today you can think about that. You could walk in the streets of Paris and think about the street as if it was a private space. In New York, it seems as if the opposite is the case. It seems to me, specifically when you go to lofts in 70s, 60s sort of like way of thinking, that those spaces feel sometimes as if they are streets. And for me, it seems as if in New York, you will have that flip of the Parisian situation where the inside will feel a little bit like an outside rather than the other way around.
Well, we are sitting right now doing this interview in one of those lofts, one of the artist lofts of the 1970s, which is still a building like that, which also itself expresses that it can be given as an example. Half of the space is what my mother, because this was her place, she called her living space, and the other half of the space is a public performance space. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, for sure. I had the opportunity to go to the Judd house a few months ago, and even the entrance that is in a way a public space, you could have looked into that space for many, many years before they actually opened the museum, is also a private space. And that for me is even more powerful, because here we still need to get through the buzzer and get upstairs, etc. But that will be a space that will be basically on street level with all these windows, and that will be where they will walk and hang out, present works of art, but it still was his own private home.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with David Kishik. His book is The Manhattan Project. One of the things that I really was attracted to in the book was your notion of the street. Walter Benjamin talked about the Paris arcade. Could you contrast the arcade of 19th century Paris to the street of 20th century New York?
I think that the idea to build basically some kind of a quasi-private, quasi-public space, as the arcade was, turned into a rather nightmarish condition. And Benjamin was very much well aware of it. He noticed how those arcades that at the beginning, when they just opened, were, you know, the coolest places where the cream of society used to visit, turned very easily and very swiftly into those places that were only visited by, let's say, prostitutes and weird people. And that is exactly what attracted the surrealist into those spaces, which is basically why Benjamin will be interested in this as well, because of them. The idea for Benjamin is that once you turn a public space, like a street, into a private space, like an arcade, privacy somehow leads to a kind of a fantasy. The fantasy, the dream, he will talk about Paris as a phantasmagoria. And then, very easily, the dream turns into a kind of a nightmare. Now, I think that every private space eventually runs down, whereof public space, a street like Broadway around here, will always remain vital, no matter what is happening, what stores come in and out, it will always remain almost eternal. If there is a sense of eternity in the city, I think it is expressed best in the emptiness of the street, in these canals of voidish air, as David Denneby used to say, I think, in one of his poems. So my idea is basically that the arcade, which turned into the department store, that turned into the mall, never had a true foothold in Manhattan in the 20th century. Yes, we had and still have remnants of department stores. However, we never had a really functional mall in the city. Even the one that we have right now, and it's kind of functional, the one in Columbus Square, has these huge windows into the square to give a sense that this is just another store window. Because otherwise, New Yorkers don't want to be in this indoor space. They much prefer the outside, even though it's not air-conditioned, etc. So I think that in 20th century New York, the public street still wins over what anywhere else in America will turn into the death of Main Street and the rise of the mall. But again, the weird thing is that every mall in America has a certain kind of a lifespan, a very short lifespan, that very easily the beautiful mall of yesterday becomes this weird place that no one wants to visit the day after.
Well, it's interesting when you say that. And first, I want to say that when you say the empty street, you don't mean a street empty of people. You mean a street that can be eternal. You know, Broadway has been around since this was founded as a colony in New Amsterdam.
since the 1811 commissioner's plan to lay down the grid of Manhattan, Broadway was already set essentially in stone. Those streets, this grid, became that unchangeable element in the city. We could change these buildings. Actually, here it's not so easy because since the 50s and the 60s, they are protected. But for me, the street is essentially what I call non-architecture. It is empty because it is not the built form. It is the space of what I will call either lived form or what I eventually call sheer life.
This book that you're analyzing, this fictional book of Walter Benjamin's, The Manhattan Project, that you're analyzing in this book, it takes place, is written during a time of crisis in New York City. A different crisis, almost the polar opposite of the crisis that is happening now. Then was a time when the city's monetary values, its exchange value of its buildings was going down. That's why Soho, in fact, could be a place for artists. It was incredibly cheap. Now it's a place where ordinary people are being moved out of neighborhoods. So I wanted to ask you, you talk about sheer life. What happens to sheer life in a gentrifying city, and how do you construct that within the context of your book?
It is a difficult subject. I think that on the one hand, we used to sigh at the reliction of the city. Now we sigh at its revitalization in a way. I think it's a pretty established fact that when the cranes are silent, the muses are having a ball, basically. And that is what happened in mid-20th century Manhattan. Could it still happen today? Increasingly, it is becoming very, very, very difficult. I think, though, anytime a person that lives in New York may be of any kind of a faith, but the first deity that you need to worship is called the deity of the real estate, the landlord, essentially. Whatever it is that is your agenda, whether you're an artist or work in finance, the biggest chunk of your paycheck is always going to go to Moloch, essentially, what Allen Ginsberg will see as this menacing force over the city. Yes, we do talk a lot, urban thinkers talk about the right to the city. Who has a right to the city these days? However, I believe that the very question of rights is a question that has to do with sovereign states rather than with urban spaces. It is the state that gives and takes rights away. Cities actually don't have that power within their jurisdiction. So the right to the city, I'm wondering what can really be done about this. One of the things, the last things I remember that Jane Jacobs said once when someone asked her, what can we do with Soho? Because it used to be a great place. She had a great hand in making it still viable rather than a place through which a highway will pass. And she already saw how both Soho and her old neighborhood, Greenwich Village, will transform into a space of luxury living. And her answer was actually unpredictable. She said, when a neighborhood is boring, even the rich people leave, get out of there, basically. I don't think that it was in her philosophical way of thinking about the city, a place to actually feel that kind of like, oh, what can we do with these neighborhoods? You move someplace else and you try there. I don't necessarily think that there is much to be done, unfortunately.
Hmm. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with David Kishik. He's a philosopher, an urban philosopher, and his book is The Manhattan Project. You talk about New York City as the Archimedean point, the kind of the fulcrum from which the rest of the world moves. What do you mean by that?
The question is not really about the centralization of power, but of what Benjamin will call, or what we can call, a paradigm. A place that if you make some kind of a sense of, you could make sense of something that is much grander than itself. Again, what we will basically think about as modernity as such.
It seems like a lot of what you're talking about in this book boils down to what makes a city a place where human beings can actually live.
Yes, that's essentially what I call sheer life. The city for Benjamin is a landscape built of sheer life. I think that the biggest mistake that we can make is to think about cities in general, and New York in particular, as some kind of a built form. I want to think about it as a lived form. Architecture is exactly what, even though this will be our knee-jerk reaction when we think about, oh, what is New York? You see a big building. In reality, I think that that notion is a way to distract us from what the city really is. I feel that every time that even I look at a building in New York as I walk by, I feel a little bit, teeny bit like a tourist still. Because the insider, in a way, is the one that is no longer so much interested necessarily in the architecture. For me, the city is a landscape built of sheer life. And that is what I'm really interested, basically. What is that urban form of life? What does it mean to live a modern life, given the fact that it necessarily means to live an urban life?
When I look at buildings in New York City, I see the layers of history. Some of them kind of ironic. For example, right across the street, I found out yesterday, the Uniqlo department store used to be a church. And if you go inside, you'll see it is still laid out in the crucifix form, which is in some ways an ironic comment on history, the history of architecture in a city.
Of course. And one of the things that New York changed architectonically was the very fact that because you have a grid, the churches that used to be the center of the city could no longer have that position. A church will just be another building on the block. It could not be the center into which all the streets will have their direction pointed at. And that is something that was rather important because, in a way, I believe that capitalism is our religion. Mm-hmm. When you go to Uniqlo, you will have that stacks of clothes forever, as if, you know, it's never ending. There is as if no sense of scarcity in those places. Mm-hmm. There are just endless merchandise. That's the religion that we all practice on a daily basis. And this is what New York represents to a great extent, which is why I'm trying also to do something in this book. Philosophers don't like to talk about economy. Most philosophers can't really deal with that earthly material thing called the economy. But I just felt that as I was walking on the Arcades on the Manhattan Project, excuse me, I had to. And that actually what led me to read Jane Jacobs' books beyond The Death and Life of Great American City. I think that the biggest mistake that we make is that we insist on her theory on that book, which is what basically leads to the gentrification of all those nice little Manhattan neighborhoods. But actually, she has a very powerful economic theory, the economy of cities, that is neither communist nor capitalist, but is something that I think could take us to a new level of thinking about what is the economy.
Could you summarize it in her point of view on the economy of cities? What do you see as her vision that could be a guide to us?
On the most simple level, we can say this. We think about the city while wearing some kind of an economic theory as glasses on our noses. It's either a capitalist theory, or actually, usually, with most urban thinkers, it is a Marxist theory. My point is that we need to flip the situation. Rather than have some kind of an economic ideology with which we analyze the city, let's try to think about what is actually happening in the city, how work actually begins, as she calls it, in a city, to use that as essentially the engine of any economic activity. In the 20th century, basically, both if you are, you know, a neoliberal like Friedman or a sort of a Keynesian, you still insist that the basic economic unit is the state. the monetary idea is that we have, you know, a currency of the entire states, etc. And even though you try to get rid of the control of the state over the economy, specifically if you are from the Chicago School of Economy, you will still insist on the very powerful woke of the state run economic system. She will basically toss this out of her theoretical window. She will start actually with the basic economic unit being the city rather than the state. And that opens up a whole new way of thinking about what is the economy when you think about it as urban economy rather than as sovereign economy.
So what might that mean in practice?
The practice is actually that in order to produce new things, in order for an economic system to actually thrive, you have to have very powerful urban centers, as New York actually always was and still is. Although we don't make in buildings like this one shirts and other garments, we do produce a lot of goods that can be immaterial rather than material. That's what we call immaterial labor. And that is still something that a city like New York will export to the rest of the world. And that what still makes it a viable place to actually make a living. I think that practically, it seems as if all economic activity focuses on those urban centers.
It seems a very deracinated idea, however. We are material beings, but we are producing immaterial commodities. There has to be some connection to the material, and in a city where, you know, famously has been called the Tale of Two Cities, how can we create a city that's livable for all of us within the notion that you're talking about?
Actually, one of the interesting things that are happening right now, actually not in Manhattan, but usually in Brooklyn, is that all these gentrifiers, let's call them that way, all these people that have a very nice college education and seems to actually not need to do material work, insist on it. And they will produce all these different goods and sell them for very high prices. But still, you actually have people in cities that will be interested, for instance, something like urban farming, etc. There is actually something kind of interesting about people that will come back to actually produce something in small batches, which is again what Jacobs was very much interested in. She realized that the way cities work is that you have all these little shops and they're all very much inefficient. The worst thing she thinks about the economy is that when it becomes too efficient. That's what happened to Detroit. Detroit was a place where you had thousands of little shops that made a lot of little things that ended up becoming cars. By now, you basically have one company that rules all the other different, oh, you have three, whatever. But the point is that it is essentially very, very efficient machine that we saw what it did to that city. It's actually the most important thing for Jacobs is that all these big companies will break into small companies. Someone that made at the beginning corset will turn into the new factory that will make this new thing called the bra. And that was something that was invented by Maidenform, I think, in the early 20th century. And that will be one of those her example for how a certain type of work will break into new types of work. And that what for her is the greatest indication of a viable economy. Not how many things we can make, but how many different weird things we can make.
David Kishik. We have to cut the interview here for this broadcast, but you can hear the extended version on our website, writersvoice.net. And you can also read an excerpt there from The Manhattan Project by Kishik. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.